The following content is provided under a Creative Commons license. Your support will help MIT OpenCourseWare continue to offer high-quality educational resources for free. To make a donation or view additional materials from hundreds of MIT courses, visit MIT OpenCourseWare at ocw.mit.edu.
Today we're going to finish up talking about some of the inputs from rivers and hydrothermal vents. So what we're going to talk about today, we discussed the generation of vent fluid and the generation of rivers. So today we're going to talk about what happens when these enter the oceans. So when rivers enter the oceans, and this is in terms of estuaries. So I'm going to spend the first third of the class on that. Then I'm going to talk some about groundwater and how groundwater input can also affect estimates of fluxes from the continents into the oceans. And then finally, we're going to look at vent fluid entering the oceans. And this includes both the formation of deposits as well as of plumes. And while the deposits are left on the ocean floor and are sort of a near source issue, the plumes actually can rise 200 to 300 meters above the seafloor, and you're at about 2,500 meters depth in the oceans, and you actually create a lot of mixing in a part of the ocean where you wouldn't normally suppose that you were going to have a large driver of mixing. So it has a lot of implications for physical oceanography and for chemical processes that are at a depth that we didn't really consider that important 30 years ago. Okay. All right. So before I start, or the first thing I want to talk about is that when rivers enter oceans and when vent fluid enters oceans, you have contrasts. And you're going to have different contrasts for different ones of the fluids. For rivers, your dominant contrast versus the oceans is the change in salinity. So that's the key one for rivers. And the key one for vent fluids, or there's two really, it's temperature, which actually creates a large buoyancy, and I'll get to that. So it's temperature and pH are your key differences. So going back, I want to remind you of what the rivers were like or how rivers were generated. We started with rainwater and rock. You have weathering. You have congruent dissolution, discongruent dissolution. And the key thing is you create a fluid that's carrying both dissolved ions, but also you have particles. And on those particles, you have adsorbed metals. And you also have clays, iron oxyhydroxides, and humic matter. Put that up there. And those all have negative charges, and so those have ions associated with them as well, and we'll get into that. And we went briefly through, at the very end of the river lecture, we went briefly through trace metal release when you have pH changes. So you can have subtle changes. The pH of river water is going to vary from about 5 to about 7. Is that right? Probably, maybe a little more. And depending on what its pH is, that can have some effect, but those aren't the dominant ones. It really is this change in salinity. And then the last thing for the rivers was on top of all of this, you have the cyclic salt, the cyclic salts. Okay. So that's just sort of a review. Hopefully you have your notes today. If not, you'll have to remember them because it's much easier to show these pictures as we go through the different types of estuaries. So essentially what you're doing is a river's coming down to the oceans, and it's going to enter, and any of you who've been near a river mouth, there's multiple different types of estuaries. And the key things that are going to affect the type of mixing in that estuary have to do with the discharge rate. If you've got a very high rate of discharge, you're going to have one style of mixing. And it also has to do with the depth that the estuary is at. And so we're going to discuss four different types of estuaries briefly. And in these figures, and my apologies for the quality, they were Xeroxed initially, I think about 15 years ago, and have been written on and Xeroxed again. So the first type is type A. And here you have, and it's where you have a shallow estuary with a small river. So you have a small discharge coming into a small estuary. You have a lot of these around here. And what, on this figure, what we have, you have four stations, 1, 2, 3, and 4. And then this just shows the mixing. So you have a station, the surface. What is that? I don't even know what that's supposed to be. Oh, this is station 1, 2, 3, 4. But this is the surface. This is the bottom of the estuary. And this is simply showing the type of mixing that's going on. So when you have low discharge into a small estuary, you have a well vertically mixed processes going on. So you're basically bringing fresh water out. And then you're going to have some tidal sloshing back and forth. But you end up, what you want to do is take a look at, if you look at what the salinity profile is at each of these stations, you go over to the next side of your figure, and pretty much the salinity is not stratified at all. Okay. So these estuaries they're dominated by tidal mixing. They're vertically well mixed. And this is all in your notes, probably not as bulleted as this, but they're vertically well mixed. There's a net outward flow at all depths. And there's a seaward increase in salinity that's similar at all depths. Okay. Now, you can also have the same thing going on, but you can end up with, also in a shallow estuary, but you can end up with a two-layer system. And for this two-layer system, we have the same thing going on. First, let's look at what's happening with the flow. The low salinity river water is flowing out on the upper part. Seawater is flowing in on the lower part. And this is dominantly density driven. But then you still have some vertical mixing. And you end up, if you take a look at the profiles across each of these stations, you end up with a slightly stratified salinity gradient.
And what determines if an estuary is type A or type B, what would cause the
inflow of seawater? I think it has to do with the discharge. A lot of it has to do with the discharge rate. Okay. If you have a, correct me if I'm wrong, if anybody, I mean, if you have a high enough discharge, it's simply a mass balance. You know, you're pushing flow out, you're going to draw fluid back in. It's more of a physical, you'd have to look at the physics of the system.
Also, if you have a really shallow estuary, it gives you more turbulent mixing, and so you have
right.
better vertical.
Right, but these were both for small, for shallow. So yeah. Both of these have fairly good vertical mixing, but you do have the... but you can also, and this is the other thing, you can also have the same estuary have the different types at different times of the year. In fact, so now I'm going to jump to there's a type D, which I really think should be type C, because it's sort of a variation on type B. And this is when you have a large river entering a shallow estuary. So again, this has to do with discharge rate. And here you end up with a salt wedge. And as in the case before, the surface waters have low salinity. Seawater intrudes underneath as a wedge. And again, here's what the flow looks like. You have a higher rate of discharge, so the flow is coming out here, and this draws in seawater is coming in here. And it's a mass balance of what's going to happen as the fluid flows. But here, instead of having a very well stratified, one of the key differences is you end up with this wedge. So out at station 4, the salinity increases at a much shallower depth, whereas at station 1, it's fairly fresh down towards the bottom.
Okay.
And there's an example in your notes about the Chesapeake Bay, where at times of high discharge you have a salt wedge, and at times of lower discharge you have a vertically stratified. Now you also have the situation where you have a very deep estuary, and the example we're using here is that of a fjord, and you have a sill located here, and again this shows the flow. The freshwater is flowing out at the upper levels. You have return of seawater at lower levels, but not at the deepest levels because you have the sill blocking those deep levels. But then what happens is you end up with higher salinity fluid basically pooling underneath behind the sill, and it's not mixing up as often. And so you end up with a very highly stratified salinity gradient. And the reason we're talking about these salinity gradients is that the major change, the key property that is affecting whether or not you have non-conservative processes is this change of salinity. So it's important to know where the major change in salinity is occurring within the estuary. Okay. And so again, this just shows a picture of the different types, and you'll have a lot of mixing, but you're mixing up in the shallower region because you have a sill which is preventing entrainment down here. Okay. Right. So now we get into what are the processes that are going to occur, the non-conservative processes that occur in estuaries. And we went over this last week. I'm going to show you a lot of diagrams, and most of these are going to be salinity diagrams where you have the seawater salinity here and freshwater salinity here. And you have some element here. And so if this is seawater salinity and this is freshwater salinity, if it's conservative mixing, you're simply going to have a straight line. And of course, if you have removal, you're going to be coming on this side of the straight line. So that's removal here, and this is addition here. Okay, so you have a number of different things going on. A key one you have going on, we talked about what's in the water, and one of the main things that's going on is you have particles in the water. So you have river colloids. And again, these are dominantly iron and humic substances. And what happens is the sea salt, well, for all of these, we talked about them having a negative charge on the outside, and this is described well in your notes. Basically, the colloids are electrically charged submicron particles. Okay, there's going to be the clays, the organic material, and some of the humic, and some of the iron oxyhydroxides. So they're too small. They're very, very small. They're not going to undergo gravitational settling. And this negative charge on the outside, they're these electrostatic interactions which keep them in solution and help to keep them in solution. What happens is when you bring in a higher salinity fluid and you bring in salts, this neutralizes the electrostatic charges. The electric charges. So when the electric charges are neutralized, the colloids clump together, they aggregate, and then they're large enough to settle by gravity. Okay. So basically you are neutralizing salts. If I could write today.
Salts.
Salts neutralize the electric charges. Which allows aggregation and then settling.
You'll sometimes hear it described as flocculate.
Right. Which actually drives me crazy because flocculation to me is all fluffy and it stays in the water. And it does for a little while, but then it gradually settles. So I'll put that as flocculation. There's two C's, right? As opposed to flagellate. Yeah, flocculation. Okay. Okay, and the second one. So that's sort of the first key. The second one that's very important is desorption. And this is what I talked about. We talked some about this going on within rivers with the pH changes, because when the pH gets lower, you can desorb some of that. When it gets higher, some of the trace metals desorb from particle surfaces. But the desorption in the river, you sometimes, and Scott talked about this on an earlier lecture, and I talked about it as well, you can have calcium released from clay surfaces and replaced by sodium. You can also have radium, can do the same thing. The third one, the first two are the key ones that are going on right in the water. If you just took a batch of seawater and took a batch on or desorption going on in terms of non-conservative processes. But there's a third one. When you can't explain it by these two, the other thing you can have happening is our interactions with estuarian sediments. So basically you have, there's pore water gradients, and so you can, if you actually stir up sediment on the bottom, you release pore fluids that are in the sediment. You also bring up sediments that have ions adsorbed on the outside, so you can release those. So really the process is one of resuspension, an interaction with the resuspended material. And the other one is release of pore waters. It's not just release, it can be release and exchange. I know. Okay, look at that, I'm all on one page.
What do you guys think the pore waters in an estuary would look like? You guys been to any of the little estuaries around here, the salt marshes? There's lots of wet in an estuary. Lots of organic matter. So if you dig down into the mud, it's a good field trip for you guys this weekend. Go to an estuary, dig down into the mud. You very quickly get to anoxic mud.
And you'll be able to tell because it'll start to smell really, really bad.
And so that's one of the things when pore waters from estuaries is you're now releasing anoxic pore waters, which are going to have very different metal composition. So in some ways there is some analogy between the pH and
right.
EH changes that we're going to talk about at the end.
Yeah. Yeah, and in fact at the very end when I'm talking about the vents, I'm going to talk about the microbial activity, but I'm not going to talk about it for the estuaries, but
we'll talk about microbes more than you guys. After the midterm.
Oh, is that right?
Six lectures on bugs.
Okay. All right, and then speaking of bugs, this is the last one, which is you can have uptake. Did you like read the notes this morning so that you could interject that properly when I needed it? Uptake by estuarian.
No, I think I have this one burned into my brain. I think I have this class burned into my brain.
You have uptake by estuarian biota, and they can remove elements, or this can remove elements. Presumably, it can also release elements, but. I think it's more the regurgitation. No, the.
I guess I'm kind of confused as to what the definition of conservative mixing is.
Oh, we'll get there. You're about to see more graphs than you ever wanted to see. Basically, each of these processes either adds or removes material. If you mixed seawater and you mixed fresh water, and you didn't do any of these things, then you'd see a perfect straight line like this. Okay? but we don't always. And for some elements we do, and I'm going to go through those, and for some of them we clearly don't. And so you have to explain why you're seeing their removal or the addition. And the a key reason why you need to know that is because if you just take the iron value that's in rivers and say that all of that iron makes it all the way out into the ocean, you're wrong, because a lot of it is left in the estuaries. And you have to try and figure out and try to quantify how much of that iron is flocculates and is settles within the estuary. So right now we're going to show you a bunch of plots.
That line, it doesn't, I mean, if that to me looks like you have something that's not in fresh water, and then you increase it as you go in salt water. Whereas if it was just
right, sorry.
Well, no.
I'm thinking into, you're right. This could be the, if it's high, and you're right. Most of them are higher in fresh water and drop that way. It can go either way. But let me just, it's easier to look at real data. The old confusing them by trying to be simple.
But if it's conservative, okay. Would it just be a horizontal?
Well, let's just show you. I'll show you the first one.
No. Then the concentration would be the same in the river.
Boron. Okay, most of these things, in order to look at mixing, first of all, you have to figure out what to plot it against, and you have to be plotting it against something that you're pretty confident is conservative. And in general, the salinity is relatively conservative. You are not dumping large amounts of halite or large amounts of any sea salt into estuaries. And we know that, therefore, you can say either chloride or salinity tends to be conservative. And so an element that is conservative should plot on a straight line relative to that property.
And where are
we on the axes? The axes, again, this is one of these. This is, I believe it's micro... It's a concentration. It doesn't matter what it is. It's a concentration. Concentration unit. And this is salinity. Okay. And if you take a look at this, you can see that within error, this boron is falling pretty much along a straight line. And so unless, whether or not there's something actually going on here or actually going on here, you'd have to put the error bars on your analyses and really try and figure that out. And we're going to get to issues with that in a little bit. But this is one where you clearly have conservative processes. You obviously can't be dumping a whole bunch of boron out unless you're dumping it with the salt. But we know that you're not dumping salt out. Okay. In contrast, here's iron. And again, it's simply concentration versus salinity. And so as you'll see, as Kristen pointed out, it can be either direction. Here there's more boron in seawater than there is in freshwater, and here there's more iron in the rivers than there is in the saltwater.
That straight line is what it would be without removal.
Right, and the straight line is what it would be if there wasn't. And these little dots, which are much, much smaller than the big, fat pen line, are the actual measurements. And one of the things that they've noted is, in general, iron and humic substances tend to follow this type of curve pretty well. And that's dominantly from flocculation of material and dumping in estuaries and precipitation in estuaries. That's in contrast to some other things, which I'll show you, which are much more complicated. Here you have barium, and again, all of these are real profiles. Instead of trying to show you these idealistic profiles, these have all been taken directly out of the literature, and it's real data, which is why they're not all beautiful profiles. This is for barium, and there's a fair amount of barium in both the freshwater and in the saltwater, but they're subtly different. But then you see this very, very large increase in barium. And that is likely from desorption. Okay. And then they show some really nice fun ones where you have copper. And again, this is the kind of thing where you go out, and a lot of this work was being done in the 70s, and they were really trying to figure out, both Ed Boyle and Ed Shulkovitz in our program did a lot of this work, trying to make sense of the data they were collecting and trying to quantify what's going on in the estuary so we can better quantify river fluxes into the oceans. And here you can see that copper it looks like it's being added at very low salinity, but then as the salinity increases some, it looks like some's being removed, and then at higher salinities, it looks like some is being added again. So copper is one that is more complicated, and you'll find that a lot of these that are more complicated are ones that have multiple different valence states. And so there's a lot of redox processes that are going on at the same time that affect what's going on. And then manganese is another. And here you show there's a large removal. In this profile, there's a large removal at low salinity and a large addition at higher salinity.
On the iron plot, sorry.
Is there a question up there?
It might be the same one. I'm not sure. Can you just describe again why the barium has the shape that it does?
Oh, the barium has the shape that it does. Well, I'd have to go back to the paper to be sure why it is, but my suspicion is it's from desorption, so that you have barium on various particles that are coming into the estuaries, and then when it mixes with the salt, the barium is being, there's exchange going on, and some other ion is replacing the barium, and the barium is being released. Sort of like calcium and sodium exchange.
Could you explain what was happening in the iron profile?
On
these plots, are you seeing just the free ion concentration, or are you seeing also that in solution, the bound to some particle?
What you are measuring here when you do this, and we'll get to it when we do the in-laboratory ones, is you're taking the fluid and you're taking the filtered portion, the less than 0.45 micron portion of the fluid, you're analyzing that and coming up with the total iron. So this is looking at total iron in the 0.45 micron and less fraction, I believe. Yeah, that's what they usually do. You'd have to read each paper carefully to find out exactly what they're doing, but in general, that's what they do. So no, you're not looking at the iron that's on the large particles that are left on the 0.45 micron filter paper, but anything that can pass through that filter is included in this.
So that would be truly dissolved free ions. It would be things that are complex in solution.
Right. So it includes...
And colloids.
Right. So if we go back to... this figure, where we were looking at what was in the river water, once you get down below this 0.45 micron, it would include some of these clays as well. Caitlin, did you have another question?
Well, I was just wondering, it looks like in the iron profile that it dips below the conservative
okay.
And rejoins it.
Perfect question. Okay. Now, one of the things is it one simple process going on? And these are all assuming that you only have two end members. You have a seawater end member and you have a freshwater end member and you don't have any other end members. And they're trying to simplify these things and come up with fairly straightforward processes that they can extrapolate globally so they can come up with a good idea of what global fluxes are. However, because of the type of thing you just talked about, Caitlin, there's also concern about whether or not there might be a third component. And so there are some examples, and this shows one here. This was work done by Ed Boyle. He went and looked back at, this is a dissolved silica profile. And what could be, it could be interpreted, a lot of people would just interpret that as simple from either colloids adsorption or something else. But what he attributed it to instead was a third component, a third mixing, a third end member. And the reason for that is silica tends to be conservative when you mix, and it was very somewhat confusing why you would see this decrease, because what would be the removal mechanism? Nobody had a removal mechanism. So his hypothesis is that there's a third source here of fluid that has a lower silica composition, and that you actually have conservative mixing between this source and the seawater source, and between this source and the river source.
Can you
Can you point out what in the iron that you're talking about?
Oh, you know, we're going to get there. We're going to get to that's messy data. Again, none of these have error bars on them. You also, all you have to do is have one aggregate get into your bottle or have one colloid stick to the side of your container. I mean, there are a lot of things that can create noise in these data sets. Okay. But the key thing of this is for you to understand how to look at a profile and determine whether there's been removal or addition, and to have some idea of what is likely causing that removal or the addition. And again, here, what confused the reason Ed Boyle went back to look at this was, in general, he was finding in other profiles that silica was conservative, so an alternative interpretation of this is that you have a third source, fluid source.
So an example of that would be like two different ocean currents mixing with a river.
Or having
two rivers and the coastal water, something like that.
Right, either two rivers and a coastal water, or in this case it was actually a shelf source. And we're going to get into groundwater flow as well. You can end up with a groundwater flow source. He ended up with for this one in particular, he had a river source, an open ocean source, and then an intermediate shelf source. I'm not sure what the source of the shelf source was, but it didn't go into that. But there was basically, you could then go out and sample that body of water, do some CTD casts, and see if you can actually find that fluid out there. Okay. All right. Now, because of these complexities and some of the questions that Caitlin was raising, you do have a concern and a problem when you have messy data. I talked about some of the issues, and here is a profile that shows copper and a mixing line. And the real question is this actually conservative mixing, or do you have some addition going on here and a little bit of addition going on there? You know, what's really going on? And the data are very, very noisy. So Ed Shalkovitz was one of the key people who helped develop this. You can also do your own mixing diagrams. This is all field data. So you can just take one option is to go out to the open ocean. So go to this station, collect a bunch of this water, go to the river source, collect a bunch of that water, the fresh source, and then do the mixing in the lab. And you can either do this mixing depending on if you want to look at particle processes or colloid processes. You either filter or do it unfiltered. This is an example of an unfiltered river water. It says unfiltered river water's 0.4 micron filters, which implies that it's filtered seawater. But anyway, you have to know what. You would report in the paper exactly what you did with those fluids. But when they did that mixing experiment, this was the data they got from the mixing experiment, and it really...
I'm still confused as to the definition of conservative mixing versus non-conservative mixing, because, is it lab mixing or is it field mixing? Because some of the processes that we went over wouldn't happen in a lab. And
right.
If they're not happening in a lab, but they're happening in the field, what you call it, and,
you call it non-conservative mixing no matter what's going on, but you have to identify the process that's going on. So you're right. This type of mixing experiment is only going to look at desorption, chemical processes between those two bodies of water. It's not going to be considering any of this resuspension of sediment.
Or biota, right,
unless there's, except for microbial activity that's actually taking place in the water column. In the two fluid samples that you've taken, but it's certainly not going to. But for this is what they were looking at. They were trying to figure out, is copper being desorbed? Is there addition or is there removal or is it being adsorbed? Okay. And then this was, some other examples are in your notes. This is a much messier one. Take a look at that nice nickel profile, and I'm sure that scatter in large part has to do with errors on the analyses. And then when they did it in the lab, they got a much cleaner data set. And similarly, and then for cadmium, the data were again ambiguous. For instance, is there actually a third source sitting here? Or is this simple desorption? And when they did the mixing calculation, or the mixing experiments in the lab, they saw that you get this non-uniform, you know, you get more desorption occurring at low salinity than at high salinity, and that, but the entire profile can be explained by desorption. Okay? And again, all of these details, I mean, there isn't, you cannot just look at a data set and identify exactly what's going on. It's simply an interpretation of field data. And as shown by Ed Boyle going back and reinterpreting one, the interpretations that are out there for all of these profiles are not necessarily 100% true. I mean, this is their hypothesis as to what's going on right now. Now, there's a, again, in your notes, there's sort of a generalization. This table sort of gives you an idea of, in general, what happens with various ions. And in general, silica, can you actually see that? Probably not. But silica, uranium, nickel, selenium, arsenic, a lot of these things in most river and estuaries are conservative, except for manganese, actually. It can differ. It can be any. So this basically talks about whether or not there's input, namely addition, whether there's removal, or whether there tends to be conservative mixing. And it generalizes, and you'll see that copper, manganese, and a couple of other elements can have any one of the three going on, depending on what estuary they're in. Okay.
What's the sign for the universal behavior that got cut off at the bottom? Is that like the underlined or the circle around the
cotton? I believe it's the underlined. That's universal behavior. And so you'll see that barium is almost always, so barium, radium, cadmium are almost always added, whereas iron and beryllium and aluminum are almost, and rare earth elements are almost always removed. And humics.
Is that what the AG is?
The humic acids. Okay. But you'll notice that it's not very many of these that have this universal behavior. I'm surprised. Oh, silica is removed sometimes. Okay. You can also have some other interesting things happen. There's an example of uranium, a nice nasty one. And this, I'm sorry, this plot is truly hideous. It's best to read the notes and read the figure caption. But all this is really showing is that in some places you tend to have conservative mixing of uranium. In others, you have a removal of uranium. And in others, you have addition. And supposedly, on this diagram, you see addition of uranium, but I can't see it myself. And one of the hypotheses for what's going on is that the uranium is bound in the iron oxyhydroxides. These colloids, and this is in your notes, these colloids flocculate, they settle on the bottom, then these iron oxyhydroxide coatings dissolve, releasing the uranium back up into the water column. So with time, you end up with an addition of uranium in the estuary.
Well, the iron oxyhydroxides dissolve in the noxic sediments, right? Is that the key step?
Yeah. I would think, because, except you can also have exchange. I mean, uranium is, we don't need to go into all the details. The point is, as I said before, I don't want you to memorize exactly what's happening to every element. I want you to understand the processes that can go on. And another process that can lead to addition is interaction, is dissolution of material that has settled on the bottom as the conditions change. And if there's any dissolution or any ion exchange going on, things can get desorbed later, things that take a longer time than they take. So it's just, you just have to think about what processes could possibly be going on. Okay, now we're going to get into radium isotopes, which is going to segue us into groundwater. But in general, radium isotopes can help unravel some of these very complex processes that are going on. I have to make sure that I have to speed up, otherwise I won't get to my favorite part. So the vents will get shafted again. Okay, so radium isotopes. Bill talked about radium isotopes. I'm not going to go into all the details, but you know that there are multiple different isotopes of radium. Radium behaves similarly to calcium and barium. And you can have radium adsorbed on exchange sites. Such as negatively charged, on the exchange sites of negatively charged clay particles in river water. And then it is rapidly desorbed in estuaries by ion exchange. And the ion exchange occurs as salinity increases. However, if the radium was only occurring because of this mixing, you would expect to see the exact same ratios. So you'd expect, if you see the isotope ratios, you ask yourself the question, are isotope ratios the same on the particles, on the river particles, as they are in the estuary water? And the answer is no. Okay. Basically, there's a lot more radium-224 than the radium-224 is too high in the estuary. And when they looked at that, they then took a look at what other processes might be happening, and that was when they account for this excess radium-224 by resuspension of sediments. And that results in extra release of radium-224, which can grow into the sediments because it grows in rapidly, whereas radium-226 and radium-228 take a lot longer to grow in. So 224 radium grows in to said particles more rapidly. Okay. And that allows you to use radium isotopes as tracers of processes. And there are a couple graphs in your notes. I'm not going to go through them because you can look at them, but they show excesses. They show addition of radium. And when you do these calculations, well, I'll just show you one. Take a look at the radium-224, 226, and 228, and you see that there's much greater ingrowth of, I mean, much greater abundances in addition of radium-224. Wonderful figures.
But you can't see the symbols, so you don't really know which one's which.
Well, you can in your notes.
You can, okay.
Yeah. One of the things we're trying to do is figure out the time to redraft every single one of these figures, but we also have to go back and find exactly what paper they all came out of. So, okay. All right.
How not to obey the copyright
law. Right, exactly. That's the next problem. Okay, so, well, it's fine for... as long as you're lecturing.
But I mean these, since we don't have the paper.
Right. That's right. Yeah. Okay. All right. So groundwater.
Question?
Yeah.
I'm a little confused by this term that you said growth in, that radium-224 has a
faster growth. Do you remember Bill Martin had the whole lecture on radium and thorium isotopes?
Are you saying that it's how fast it is derived from its parent isotopes? Is that
yes.
What you mean by growth in?
Okay. Yes. So radium-224, you're basically producing much radium-224 is being produced much more rapidly than radium-226. It's growing in. It's called growing in.
Well,
it's
another way of saying that is because radium-224 has a shorter half-life,
right.
When you have a perturbation, it will reach secular equilibrium with its parent more rapidly than a longer-lived radium isotope. And we went through that a little bit, how long something takes after a perturbation to get back to secular equilibrium. And that depends upon the half-life of the daughter isotope.
Okay. And again, it's described in fairly well in the lecture notes, but then you'd also want to go back to the lecture notes or actually do a problem where you're using radium isotopes so that you really understand how it works. It's tough to understand it the first time you go through a lecture.
And how do you distinguish from a radioactive process versus a kinetic fractionation of different isotopes? Like if you're...
But what's the mass difference between radio?
Well, sure, it's relatively small, but I mean...
Very small.
But you could presumably measure very small.
Well, okay, but the signals you're seeing are much larger than what you can expect by mass fractionation.
And I'm going to
just be in context of what you see.
And I'm going to be talking about radium isotopes a little more in the groundwater, so let's answer those questions once we've gone through all of this.
I won't talk about it more in isolation.
Oh, you will? Okay, good. Because otherwise I won't get to vent fluids. Okay, groundwater. Groundwater is fairly, well, it's it was overlooked for many years. Basically, you have a continent, you have, just as, you know, you have the oceans here, you have a continental system, and you've got some kind of aquifer going on and groundwater within the continents. And so there's got to be some kind of mixing zone between the two.
Can you put the bottom of the ocean in there so they can see the land? Just hits the top of the water.
Calm down. I like it this way. There's groundwater, there's oceans, and this is what we see from the surface, and we have no idea what's going on underneath. And it can vary, so I'm getting there. So you end up in the groundwater, you have both an undersaturated zone or an unsaturated zone. And this is areas where the soils dry out, get wet, dry out, get wet, dry out. And there can be a lot of chemistry going on in these. And also the flow of fluids through these is very different in an unsaturated zone. And probably could tell us most of... I'll have other people talk when I'm confused. Okay, then you have the water table surface. And below the water table height, though, is going to vary, but there is a zone where it's a saturated zone. And that's all you really need to know, is that there is groundwater, there's undersaturated zones, there are saturated zones, and you can also have impermeable strata, and this is why I haven't drawn the ocean coming out like that? Well, then where's my mixing zone? My mixing zone is in here somewhere. This is Cape Cod, it's very flat. Anyway, then you can also have impermeable strata, which I put my mixing zone through. So you can have impermeable layers. You might have a granite layer. See, now I've completely messed up this picture, so ignore the picture. This is why I didn't put it in the bottom of the ocean. And you can actually have artesian aquifers confined in between these impermeable strata. The impermeable strata can be clay, it can be granite, and for instance on the Cape you have large channels of glacial deposits, which are much coarser, and a lot of the flow is within those glacial channels. Okay. So the key thing is that the water can either, you can have nearshore seepage, and this is when you have a positive potentiometric head. Just means the pressure is higher. And that's if the water table is above the sea surface. You can have spring discharge. And the springs, again, are these aquifers that are confined by impermeable strata. And you can even have offshore seepage where you have a breach in an impermeable strata that's offshore. Now, the thing about groundwater is it's a lot like the hydrothermal fluid sources that I was telling you about. It's very difficult to find out where the groundwater is entering the estuaries and where it's entering the oceans. And it's not always estuaries. You can just have coastlines and along a beach. Where exactly is the groundwater entering? So how do you go about measuring it? One way you do it is you have seepage meters. This is described in your notes. You basically are putting out a big box with closed sides, and you're seeing what, if there's a lot of seepage, it's going to inflate a sampling container, and you'll be able to calculate what that flux of groundwater is. But that's just one spot. And how do you know if that one spot is representative of all of the other spots? And we know that for instance, along the Cape, we know that you don't have a nice homogeneous sediment layer, and you don't have a nice homogeneous coastline. And so it's very difficult to try and figure out if you've pinned down all of the sources and what the relative magnitudes of sources are. So what are you going to use instead? What do we use for hydrothermal fluids? We took a look at an element that's in a hydrothermal fluid, and we ratioed it to what? We ratioed it to heat.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
Okay.
I like helium.
And you can ratio it to helium, which would be nice, except that helium is not conservative and we don't understand exactly how it works, so it would be a very bad thing to ratio it to. But chemical oceanographers like helium better.
That's exciting. So, because it always changes.
Okay, so in groundwater, what are you going to ratio it to? Or what are you going to use instead as sort of a tracer? Yeah, something we just talked about. You're going to look at radium isotopes. Because you have much higher concentrations of radium isotopes in the groundwater than you do in seawater. And that is because...
It also
depends where you are. Again, this is a geological issue. It all depends what your soil's composition are and what the rock compositions are, especially in this area of the world where you have dominantly granitic sands and granites, and everything that's been dumped on the Cape is loaded with granite. There's lots and lots of radium in the soil, so you end up with a very high radium. And most of the East Coast, you have high radium in the groundwaters. Okay. And?
So let me just make sure this is clear. The radium is produced from the uranium decay series.
Right.
And it's soluble in water. So just washes out.
Hopefully it washes out. The other thing is most of you, if any of you have basements in your houses, depending where you are on the Cape or in New England, you end up with a radon buildup in your basement. And the reason you have a radon buildup in your basement is because the granites and the glacial moraines here are very high in uranium. You have a lot of decay. You end up with radon buildup. So if you've got a nice, tightly constructed house, it's not a good thing. Okay. I'm going to go through this pretty quickly because otherwise I always leave my stuff for last and I don't get to it. So groundwater, in order to use tracers, and you're going to do this in your problem set, so I don't have to go through it in a lot of detail, because my main point while going through this was that it was going to, is that it's a lot, you really can't understand this unless you actually do the calculation. So what you do is you use an element whose main source to the coastal water is groundwater, such as radium. The element must be conservative in coastal waters. And you're using radium-226. And, of course, we just discussed how it's not conservative, but I'm not going to get into the inconsistencies here. You guys can discuss that later. Then you map the concentration of the tracer. And then this is the part that you get to do in your problem set. You use a freshwater balance to determine the exchange rate of water between coastal water and the open ocean. This is in your notes. There's a little box model. I'll show it to you in a second. And then you calculate the flux of the tracer from the coastal water to the open ocean, and that must equal the tracer input from the groundwater into the coastal water. And instead of moving that, I'll try and draw your box model on the side. Well, I'll leave it there for a little while. Basically, what you have is a box model for the coastal water, a box for the coastal water, and this is in your notes. You have a box for the coastal water, you have a box for groundwater, you have a box for the open ocean. You know the fluxes into, or you know the direction of fluxes into both. You know the salinities, and you can measure the salinities in the open ocean, in the coastal water, and in the groundwater. And then you iterate. You basically have a series of equations, and you iterate on a series of equations.
Rivers.
Excuse me?
What about rivers?
You mean how they're affecting the...
Are they a separate box?
No, because you're assuming that the rivers, that the coastal water is already accounting for the input of the river water. So you're not doing this right at the mouth of the river. You're doing this within an estuary, for instance, and you're looking at what the bulk of that coastal water is relative to the open ocean, relative. You basically do it when you don't have a river coming into the same place.
In our problems that we do, and it is another box.
Oh, man. Okay, this is a good thing for recitation if you don't understand it. Other people have done the problem. I haven't seen the problem. Okay, so you got four boxes. You add another box.
But it does raise a good point. Often it's hard to deconvolve the effects of groundwater from rivers. Particularly if the groundwater is coming into an estuary. It takes a lot of work to do that.
Right. And that's what we're going to end with for the groundwater here is this figure from your notes, which shows, because I was confused about this last night waiting for you guys to ask me a question, so I came in and talked to Dan McCorkle. This shows the Mid-Atlantic Bight, and it shows values of radium-226 in surface waters. And this is Billy Moore's work, and he uses this as evidence for significant groundwater input into the Atlantic Ocean, and in fact estimates that it's as much as 40% relative to the river input of radium 220, that the groundwater relative to river runoff is as much as 40%. And my problem was, well, wait a minute, how can you distinguish between the radium 226 added from groundwater relative to resuspension of sediment? And they've done the calculations. You cannot account for these magnitudes of radium 226 from resuspension of sediments. Okay. Right. Okay. In the last part of the lecture, we're going to jump over to back into hydrothermal events and what happens when those enter. And so I want to remind you of what the composition of vent fluids looks like relative to seawater. So as opposed to seawater, river water, where you have a very strong chlorinity difference, you can have that chloride difference. Seawater is about 540 millimoles per kilogram chloride. And the vents range anywhere from less than 40, this isn't the lowest that's ever been measured, to there's actually some that's actually up as high as 1,100 millimoles per kilogram. So you can have some chlorinity effects, but the dominant effects are these. You've got very, very strong, large differences in the temperature, and you also have very large differences in the pH. And the pH of most vent fluids measured at 25 degrees NBS, by the way, which Bill Martin said you never use, but the hydrothermal people use NBS. That's largely because there's no sulfate in the water. Those fluids range from anywhere from about, well, we've actually measured ones now as low as one. So less than one to up around 5 or 5.9, depending on whether or not you have sediments. But mid-ocean ridges, it's generally around 3 to 4. So what happens when this fluid enters? You have a number of things going on, and I'm going to talk about two non-conservative processes that occur. One is deposition of deposits, or deposition in deposits. And actually, I'll call these massive sulfide deposits. And the other is deposition or precipitation in plumes. And settling. So in terms of this diagram, is it the sort of classic model is the black smoker chimney model. And this was derived from the first two people who, Marjorie Goldfarb and Rachel Heyman, were both doing their theses on this. And this is for when you're jetting pristine end-member fluid. It hasn't mixed with anything underneath the seafloor. It's coming out with close to zero magnesium concentration in it, and it has significant amounts of calcium in it. And the fluid rises, and this is what I'm talking about with the buoyancy. The temperature... The temperature difference is largely creating an extremely buoyant fluid packet. And it's going to want to rise to a level of neutral buoyancy. And it's also coming out very rapidly. So you have two things going on. One is it's coming out at very high velocities, up to 1 meter per second. And actually, it's sort of 1 to 5 meters per second. So you both have a jet component, and you also have a buoyancy component. And what this is going to do is it's going to act like a chimney. It's going to draft in a lot of bottom water, okay? Now, this also happens within the deposit down here. When you mix those two fluids, you precipitate anhydrite. And we talked about anhydrite before, how it is calcium. Basically, if you're above 150 and you have calcium plus sulfate, you precipitate anhydrite, which is anhydrous calcium sulfate. We talked also about how there's going to be strontium substitution for calcium. So you could actually use strontium isotopes to try and determine whether or not the anhydrite in the chimney is just from heating of seawater, or whether you're actually having to mix both seawater and hydrothermal fluid. And what we find is you have to mix both hydrothermal fluid and seawater. So this first wall is precipitating just from a turbulent mix of these two. And then that creates a substrate. It creates two things. It creates a barrier so you can't mix between the two fluids, and it also creates a substrate on which you can start to precipitate metals. And I'm not going to go through the details of it because we don't have time in this course, but you can... The interesting thing about these chimneys is this length scale across these walls is on the order of 1 to about 5 centimeters. And across that length scale of 1 to 5 centimeters, you have a 350-degree temperature gradient. And you can calculate what the thermal regime is inside that wall by looking at heat and mass, heat transport as a function of conduction and advection. And you can do the same thing for the mass transport as a function of diffusion and advection. And so you can actually calculate what the profiles might be, chemical and thermal profiles across these walls. And that's important for two reasons. One, to determine where minerals are going to precipitate and why minerals are precipitating various places. And the other one is that you do have microbial activity occurring within these chimneys. And you also have larger organisms living both on the inside and also on the outside of these walls. And so if you want to understand what the environments are in these, you have to actually do a good job of calculating precisely what the chemistry is in here. But this isn't something you're going to be tested on or we're going to cover here, because it becomes very complicated because of the high, steep thermal gradients. So this is sort of the generic black smoker chimney that the chemists really focused on. And the reason they really focused on, this is a little propaganda from me, the reason they really focused on them is because the majority of the fluid was going right up into the ocean, and they were like, ah, we can ignore all of these non-conservative processes going on here because we don't want to deal with them. We just want to know what the input to the ocean is. In actual fact, this is not what all deposits look like. The Endeavour segment, there are these really large structures that look like this. This is a pilot we asked to step out because there's no way of really getting a good picture with a diagram on it. This is 2,500 meters depth. What we really did was we had Dudley Foster lie down. We cut out a plywood shape. He donated a pair of jeans. We bought an Alvin T-shirt, and it was used for scale. And this is one of the first. It's taken with a CCD camera because we really couldn't describe how big these are. A lot of these structures are the size of buildings. And then you also have structures as large as the TAG active hydrothermal mound, which is a deposit that's 150 meters to 200 meters in diameter, and it's all massive sulfide deposit. And we're going to talk a little bit about the processes that form that. But as you can see in these, you actually don't just have black smokers. You actually have overhanging ledges. As soon as you have an overhanging ledge, the mass, your efficiency of keeping the mass on the seafloor, not going out into the water column, is much greater. Okay. These deposits, though, and this is another reason why people really aren't that concerned about it, the deposit composition is dominantly pyrite, which is FeS2, chalcopyrite, which is CuFeS2, sphalerite or wurtzite. These are polymorphs. A polymorph is something that has the same composition but a different structure, and that's Zn, Fe, iron and zinc substitute for one another, S. And then you have some amorphous silica. And you have iron oxyhydroxides. So if you take a look at it, they're not that concerned with these massive sulfide deposits, which actually are analogs to deposits that we mine on land. But they're not concerned about them because they're really only affecting fluxes of copper and zinc, a little bit iron and sulfur. But relative to the amount of iron that's actually transiting up into the plume, they're not that concerned about it. Okay. Nobody's actually done a really good analysis of how much of the iron, et cetera, is left in the deposits relative to in the fluids, because it's just been assumed by the chemical oceanographers that it's largely going up into the plumes.
Anybody not know that Meg's not a chemical oceanographer? Or doesn't consider herself?
I'm a chemical oceanographer. It's just that the... Anyway.
Those guys.
Okay. So that's sort of into the deposits. The other thing that can happen in the deposits is that you can actually have this entrainment that draws in fluid. You can have it occurring beneath the seafloor. And this is the TAG mound that I described to you. You don't have this figure. So you just have to listen, sit and enjoy. Instead of drafting, you're drafting the fluid up into this plume, but you're also pulling the fluid underneath. And the way we found out about this, well, first we found out about it by measuring the fluids on the surface, and there were fluids coming out of white smokers here which did not show conservative mixing. Okay? So we couldn't explain them just by a simple mix of black smoker fluid and white smoker fluid. So they drilled down into this. We drilled 125 meters depth, and we found anhydrite. And you can look at the fluid inclusions in the anhydrite, and you can look at the strontium isotopes in the anhydrite. And to make a long story short, the strontium isotopes indicate that the anhydrite dumping down here at 125 meters depth is largely seawater, between 60 and 98% seawater. And the temperature, though, is 350 degrees. So you're drawing in seawater and heating it by conduction very rapidly. And then this seawater is interacting with the hydrothermal fluid, and you're dumping large amounts of metals and having a lot of chemical interactions going on beneath the seafloor. And those fluids that exited did not have a magnesium of zero. They had the ones that were coming out here had a magnesium of approximately 10 to 14 millimoles per kilogram.
Whoops.
And that's because there aren't any magnesium phases that are precipitating. I told you what the deposits look like. They don't have a lot of magnesium phases. Okay, and that brings us to what's going on in the plumes. The other thing that's happening, and as I described at the beginning of this lecture, the plumes are exiting rapidly, and you have this large amount of very, very hot fluid. And even if it's not coming out very, very rapidly, it's still going to try to attain a level of neutral buoyancy, as all waters do in the oceans. And by looking at the chemistry of the plume waters, they have determined... Does that? Okay, on my screen, it's all blue. By about 10 meters above the vent, you've diluted the vent by 100 to 1,000 times. Okay? So if the vent is exiting right here on the table in front of me, by the time you get halfway up to the ceiling, you've diluted it already by 10 to 100 times. You precipitate large amounts of FES is pyrrhotite, and then the next one is wurtzite or sphalerite. And these are metastable phases. They just precipitate very, very rapidly. Okay? So you dump some of the iron and sulfide early. The other thing they found is that as you go further up in the plume, you still have aqueous hydrogen up to very high levels in the plume. Essentially, it takes a little while for the hydrogen to equilibrate with the oxygen in the mixed fluid. And it's not until by about 200 to 300 meters, which is where the plume actually levels out into a level of neutral buoyancy. By that time, it's been diluted by 10,000 times. So for each one part of hydrothermal fluid that's come in, it's drawn in up to 10,000 parts of bottom seawater. And that's bottom seawater at 2,500 meters depth in the ocean. Now, before I get to then what that looks like for the water profiles, I want to touch briefly on the one of the other things that can happen, and that is that you have biological activity going on both within the deposits and within the plumes. Okay? And as Scott pointed out, you'll be talking a lot about biological activity a lot. This is mostly microbiological activity. It sort of forms the bottom of the food chain at these sites. But basically, the organisms can utilize hydrogen, H2S, methane, manganese, and iron. So the vent fluids have high amounts of each of these in them. And the seawater, so the vent fluid has that, and seawater has oxygen, sulfate, CO2, and then there's also redox going on with these two as well. So redox reactions with manganese and iron, methanogenesis, sulfide reduction, or sulfide oxidation rather, or sulfate reduction, all of this creates disequilibrium. And basically the microorganisms exploit this disequilibria. Okay. So basically the microorganisms get in there before the inorganic processes take over and do the conversion. They catalyze the reactions and they use the energy. Now, the final point I want to get to is with the plumes, getting back towards physical oceanography, and also in the plumes, the same type of activity occurs within the plumes. That's why it's so important that that reduced hydrogen stays in solution for so long. You actually have a number of microbes who, especially you have manganese oxidizers and hydrogen oxidizers who operate in the plume.
All the macrofauna you see, you know, you watch the NOVA specials and you see all the clams and the tube worms and all of that are living off of microbes that are doing these reactions.
Right. And you have this figure. This is a little trophic structure figure for those of you with a that you should take a look at, and it basically is showing that you have all these, and this is, it's all inorganic, and this is a key thing. These are all inorganic molecules coming up here. They are not, they were not generated by organic processes, and they're utilized by subsurface bacteria. They're utilized by bacterial mats, and then, as Scott just pointed out, there's a very large trophic web that sits on, food web that sits on top of this hydrothermal community. And this red box basically is, are those who are living solely off of the vent fluids, but then you also have export to non-vent ecosystems. All right. Now the final thing I want to get to is what happens when this seawater, when the hydrothermal fluid exits and you entrain the bottom seawater. So what's going to happen if you're in, we talked about the Pacific and the Atlantic a little bit, and the bottom water, so when you're entraining 10,000 parts of bottom water into a hydrothermal plume, okay, your first thing is going to be, okay, if I want to look at a hydrothermal plume, I'm going to look for a temperature anomaly, right? Well, the fact is you've diluted it 10,000 times, and you've diluted it 10,000 times with bottom water. So what you really want to do is, or 2,500 meter water, bottom water at the ridge. So what you really want to do is look for the signature of that bottom water that you've entrained up a little higher in the water column, and it's balanced the temperature. By the time you've got there, you've got the salinity and the temperature balancing things. So in the Pacific, it's actually pretty much what you'd expect because you have a, because the fluid is actually at depth, is a little colder and a little more saline. Okay? So you've entrained cold, saltier water and brought it up higher in the water column. So you see a small temperature anomaly, and you also see a small salinity anomaly because you've, this is, the temperature anomaly is from the temperature difference of the high temperature fluid, and the salinity anomaly is because you brought some of this higher salinity fluid up in, up higher in the water column. And if you look at the density gradient, you can see the effluent layer in the density profile as well. This is how we used to, and it's still how we go out and look for these things on a broad scale. Now, if you go to the Atlantic, it's a little more difficult. In the Atlantic, the temperature is actually of the bottom, the salinity of the bottom water is actually lower at depth, at the depth of the vents. And this is, and this causes an interesting profile. So when you go to look for it, you see this salinity low relative to a nice salinity profile, which would be coming down like this. You see this salinity low, and that salinity low is because you've brought up some of this lower saline fluid. Now, the other thing that's kind of weird is you've also brought up enough fluid so that you actually have a temperature low as well. And again, this is because it's the combination of temperature and salinity that's going to result in a density profile. So if you're looking in the Atlantic, you're actually not looking for a positive temperature anomaly. You see a negative temperature anomaly. You're not sure exactly what it is, but then you see the salinity low, and the main thing you look at are these nephels, and the nephels are the particles that are in the plume. So that sort of gets to the point that I started out with when I talked about hydrothermal systems, is I like to think of these systems as sort of exaggerations of the key components that drive ocean circulation. If you really don't understand the subtle differences of salinity and temperature, you just study the plume dynamics and study what happens when you bring in this fluid, and you really get a much better idea about how it's the combination of salinity and temperature that determine the density. It's not a simple idea of you're bringing in hot fluid, therefore you have a hot layer over it. You have to consider the mixing processes. Okay. And questions? Any questions about any parts of the lectures? The groundwater, rivers, estuaries, vents?
So with these profiles, are you on the edge of, I mean, so this plume gets wider, right? So
yeah.
You're on the edge of it? Because presumably the closer you get to the center, the larger of an anomaly you'd see?
You don't see a larger anomaly. What you end up with, and actually that's a very good point, there's, if you drew a plume, So you have the ridge crest, you have a smoker down here, and you've got a vent field. You've got a plume that rises, and it spreads out at some point. And actually, there tends to be a little top hat to it. And so if you tow over it, this actually has fairly uniform properties all through here. If you do a profile through here or a profile through here, this part of the profile will still look close to that, although there is some, if you look at the particles and if you actually take particles, you're going to start seeing differences in concentrations of manganese, for example. Because as this goes out, I completely forgot one part, which is...
I was going to cover it.
Bill does cover it when he talks about his sediment lectures.
Okay. Okay. By the way, these particles in here, you have all these iron oxyhydroxides again. And what do the iron oxyhydroxides do in salt water? They tend to settle. When they settle, you also adsorb lots of trace metals onto them, such as arsenic. All these arsenic, phosphate, vanadium. And in fact, if you look at... So you guys are going to talk about all this?
Well, yeah, we do talk about it. You'll see shadows of, basically, as this plume gets infected away from the top of axis, you get these metal-rich sediments that are deposited.
Right. And you have two figures in your lecture notes about this. One is, this is what's going on in the plumes, and the metalliferous sediment settles out. And then... there's a distribution of metalliferous sediment on the seafloor, and you'll notice that it's all clustered around. This is the East Pacific Rise. This is the Mid-Atlantic Ridge. This is the Central Indian Ridge or the Southeast Indian Ridge. And this is actually from Bostrom et al., 1969. So this was another reason why people were expecting to find hydrothermal circulation, was they'd actually done these measurements prior to finding the vents. So I kind of got distracted from your question, but essentially the key difference is at this buoyant part of the plume. If you want to find a vent site, you have to go down so you find this buoyant part of the plume. And the profile right down the mouth is going to look very different than the profiles. And the profiles I'm showing you are the ones that are out here.
Right.
Can you just put the metalliferous sediment?
Yeah.
The last thing is as all these metals precipitate out of the plume, you still have the temperature salinity anomaly. You also have a helium anomaly, a helium isotopic anomaly, because the mantle has a different helium isotopic composition. Meg talked about that. And those actually can be tracked for thousands of kilometers away from the ridge. And that's actually been used to look at, before we had all this fancy technology for deep profiling floats that could go down to 2,000 meters and sit there. There were all these arguments of, based on the helium distribution, what the deep circulation was. We didn't even know what the sign, what the direction of the flow was until these helium anomalies were tracked.
Okay. Which brings me to a final thing, which is Bill Jenkins gave this wonderful talk where he talked about, and this again gets back into, the title of his talk was One Man's Signal is Another Man's Noise. And it really gets into, and this is why I wanted to focus on processes within this talk. Depending on what it is you study, you can utilize all of these different processes. Once you understand the processes, you can start utilizing them differently. And his talk was about how if you look at the silica, because there's also a silica anomaly which corresponds to the helium anomaly, he could subtract out that hydrothermal signature, which was really screwing him up with his ventilation. He really wanted to be able to subtract out all of the helium signature from hydrothermal solutions so that he could really take a look at ventilation and what was going on with subducting helium from the surface oceans down into the bottom oceans. And he has to get rid of the hydrothermal signature somehow. So he ratioed helium to silica. I'm oversimplifying, but...
No, actually, I ratioed helium to silica.
Oh, Scott did all of the work, apparently. And
back when I was a slave.
Basically, just remember helium can be used for two different signals in the oceans.